Welcome to a La Trobe University podcast. I'd be your host, Matt Smith. With me today is Dr. Luca Anceschi of the Politics Program at La Trobe University. Thank you for joining me, Luca.
Thank you.
Now, you're here today to talk to me about the Arab Spring and the developments that have been happening in the Middle East and around Northern Africa. In the past year, we've seen a revolutionary wave of demonstrations and protests across the Arab world. In your opinion, what has been the motivation for this change and why has it been happening now?
Before we start, a little thing about the actual name of this movement. My friends in the Middle East tell me that we shouldn't use the expression Arab Spring. The first reason for that is a funny one, because they say it didn't happen in spring, it happened in winter. But also because their idea of what was going to happen wasn't just bring a little bit of fresh air into the politics of the region, but it was much more about totally changing the system. And in this sense, the expression that they use in Arabic is the Arab Revolution, which in turn leads me to your question about what was the main causes. The main causes of these revolutions, which started in Northern Africa and then spread across the region, was at the same time political and economic. It started essentially as the ultimate act of a population that could not stand the yoke that was imposed by them, by the regimes. But it started, in fact, in December 2010 in rural Tunisia, where this Mohamed Bouabzizi guy, who was a vendor at the local market, could not overcome the red tape that was associated with his activity and set himself alight. So that's the symbol that brings both the political claim and also the economic grievances of the revolutions in the Middle East.
That one catalyst event. So do you think without that event, the Arab Revolution still would have happened?
The event is highly symbolic, but it's also indicative of its essence, which is both political and economic. It's not just about political rights here, not just about voting, not just about having access to social rights and demonstrations. It is also about the right to live a dignified life in terms of whatever states can provide to the populations. So it is in that sense that Mohamed Bouazizi gesture was the catalyst and the spark.
One thing that I should ask then is, where did the term Arab Spring come from? Is that something...
It's a Western label? Because we like it to compare to 1968 Czechoslovakia, the Prague Spring.
Yeah.
Which wasn't very much of a system, of an idea of changing the system in Czechoslovakia. It was much more having a human face, socialism. So we associate that movement with 68, but its Middle East is not used. They use the word Thawra, which means revolution.
Recently, President Assad has warned the West that any meddling in his country would carry the risk of setting the whole Middle East on fire. How has the West reacted to these uprisings?
Pretty badly, in the way in which we have had delayed support, which we saw in the Egyptian case, where President Obama, which was Mubarak's best ally, was very late in shifting field and supporting the population rather than standing up with the regimes. That was the same attitude that we saw from European patrons, in inverted commas, in the Tunisian case, where Sarkozy did not reacted as quickly as he should have when the uprising started in Tunisia, and the same when it comes to Italy in relation to Libya. So that's the first typology of bad Western reaction, so delayed support to the really democratic and popular uprising. Then we had the intervention section of the way in which the West has reacted. We saw in the case of Libya, the West decided to get involved in this revolution by taking clearly sides in a direct way, and in that sense they contributed to topple the Gaddafi regime in the longer run, although it took them much longer than it expected in the plans of NATO. But interestingly, the second kind of reaction, which is the direct intervention, was not motivated by interests in the local politics. It was the power politics in France, in the UK, that had repercussion on the way in which the West meddled with the situation in Libya. And then we had a number of other sort of shades of Western in reaction to the region, which for me, the most interesting one is the total absence of any significant reaction to the crushing of the revolution in Bahrain. which the West allowed Saudi Arabia to do pretty much whatever they wanted in the Bahraini scene in a way in which it shouldn't have. The violence that happened in Bahrain was the symbol of a regime that did not want to be opening to the world. And in fact, that would actually happen. They successfully prevented the revolution to go ahead. So we have, in short, three kind of reaction: a delayed one, a moderate intervention one, and a total absence in other cases.
Is it a case of they'll support whoever seems to be in power at the time?
It really depends on the implication that regime change in the region would have for the foreign policy of that Western actor. Getting rid of Mubarak or Ben Ali in Tunisia, that was much more problematic, especially since long-term ties established with those regimes. When it came to Gaddafi, the West had an easier way to get around its former alliance with the regime, because Gaddafi was always seen as the mad dog of Arab politics. So they did differentiate among who was easier to get rid of. It was a little bit more complicated. And we saw that in the Syrian case. In the Syrian case, the voice of intervention has never been raised convincingly, by the West. I mean, Kevin Rudd is the exception in that case, because they know that that regime would be very difficult to topple. The wider implications are going to be the discriminant that the West will use to decide whether to intervene or not.
Has the West been implicit in keeping unjust governments in power?
That's a tricky one.
Now that Gaddafi has been toppled in Libya, it's come out that quite a lot of the weapons that he had were supplied from the UK, for example.
Yeah.
As long as somebody's in power, they'll get support from Western countries, especially if they're oil countries.
Yeah, let me try to answer this. The West has been particularly responsible in ensuring authoritarian stability in the region. We always associate the idea of instability with non-democratic politics, but in the case of the Middle East, we have realized that the more authoritarian the regime was, the more stable its grip onto power was. So the West has perhaps not been instrumental in these regimes emerging, but giving legitimacy, extending legitimacy to Ben Ali, of President Mubarak, to the same extent to which the legitimacy is extended now to the regime in Saudi Arabia, which doesn't have much of a democratic facade either, was perhaps the biggest tool that the West used to prop these regimes. So I would say that our idea of governance in the region, when we had these regimes that were both stable and authoritarian, has been challenged successfully by the Arab Revolution in a way in which our perception of what the politics of the region are going now is very difficult to shape, because we are actually moving in Achadra territory.
But that goes all the way from Libya getting weapons from the UK through to Saddam Hussein being given the key to the city of Detroit.
It does go all the way, as you said. It is a matter of extending different times of support at different regimes, at different junctures, which actually complicate the relationship now between those who were at the opposition before the revolution and the Western states involved in the region. What sort of ties would be able to see? I'll give an example. Before coming to La Trobe, I used to teach in Italy, in Naples, and we organized this conference in 2006 on the idea of Muslim Democrats. And we invited Rashid Ranouchi, which is the winner of Tunisian election. His party, Ennahda, won the election last week. The Italian government did not grant Ranouchi a visa, so we could not have him on board. Now, Ranouchi will be a key player in Tunisian politics. How that sort of relation with the West that used to be looking at Ranouchi as an enemy, well, we don't know how this thing is going to shape. So we have these new roles emerging in the region with actors that have to forge new relationships with those that used to be their opponents.
Do you think social media such as Facebook and Twitter has had a big effect in the Arab Revolution, or has its prominence been overplayed?
I think that it depends on the case. Like, when we think of Libya, there is not much Twitter and Facebook going around. It's much more a civil war that was fought. And it is similar to some extent in Syria, where are actually censored by the regime. I was speaking with someone when I was last time in Damascus, and they told me that they used to connect onto a Lebanese server to use their Facebook account. So within the country was actually successfully banned or very much controlled. In the case of Egypt, yes, social media did play a major role. And the best way to understand the impact of that kind of media onto the revolution in just to highlight the fact that throughout January, the Egyptian government introduced a law that forbid people to send the same SMS to more than 10 recipients.
Really?
That was the law that was enforced because they were scared that if you would send all those SMS to many people, you could actually have a larger number to the demonstration. Of course, that law didn't work. We have seen that with the use of Facebook and Twitter, the Egyptian population did go into the streets and stay there for a long time.
The Arab Revolution has been successful in bringing down unwanted regimes. What do you think they need to do now to establish political order?
That's a tough question, but an interesting one. I am slightly pessimistic of the outcome of these revolutions. We've seen in Egypt that almost 10 months down the track, not much has changed in terms of the way in which stability is perceived throughout the country. And in fact, the army is still playing a key role. I can't see any possible way in which they will decide to be more marginal in that context. And the whole issue of the interconfessional, interreligious violence that between Muslims and Copts, some people have said that it was fomented by the army itself. So the Egyptian case still doesn't have easy way out from the transitional government that we saw in the last 10 months. The Libyan case, well, if the government wants to establish a democracy, they haven't started with the right foot. And we saw the way in which the Gaddafi killing was perpetrated. It wasn't really a good start for someone who wants to embark on a peaceful democratic transition. In the case of Libya, I think that it would be the combination of political rights and fairer redistribution of wealth when it comes to oil revenues that would make the difference. Tunisia, so far, is the case that we could look at with more interest because they have held election. It seemed to be a bit orderly now, although there have been a few instances of problems in different parts of the country when it comes to the election procedure. Although to establish democracy, you don't just need to vote. That's the minimum requirement. You need to establish procedures, check and balances, institution making that will have to look at different kinds of policy. In the case of Tunisia especially, it would be the economic restructuring of the country that will make the difference. Because it started over there because the people were very distressed by the poor economic condition they were experiencing. So the outlook, it started to get better. I see it to be pessimistic, but it will take a bit of time. If we do the same interview in 12 months down the track, we will have a better picture.
Yeah. What countries do you think are in risk of toppling next in the Arab Revolution?
For me, the key uprising is the one that's happening in Syria. Because Syria, it is a key player. When it comes to the geographic position, the geopolitics of the region, very active foreign policy, so it is a major player in the region. Unlike Egypt, that before experienced a decline in the last decade of the Mubarak, so it was marginalized in any sort of meaningful discussion in the region. And also, most important, because Syria, it still has not signed the peace with Israel. So Syria is an actor that should experience some sort of regime upheaval. You will have major implications for the region as a whole. You could even get to a point in which Syria will actually be subdivided in different entities. It is a fairly fragmented political landscape. And I believe that the regime will do anything in their own capability to try to keep quashing upheaval, especially because Syria is the case in which a minority does rule the majority of the country in terms of confessional politics. But it is by far the most important of the upheavals. I think it's probably as important as the Egyptian one. The Egyptian one was very important in terms of the symbolic, because Egypt used to be the cultural center of the Arab world. At one stage was even the political center of the Arab world, and it's a big country in terms of population, 80 million plus. Whereas Syria it is the major actor when it comes to foreign policy.
That's all the time we've got for the La Trobe University podcast today. If you have any questions, comments or feedback about this podcast or any other, then send us an email at podcast@latrobe.edu.au. Dr. Luca Anceschi, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.